Our topic for tonight is Abraham Geiger, the granddaddy of Reform Judaism. And the particular focus we'll have for tonight is a controversy that surrounded his appointment as the assistant rabbi in the town of Breslau in Germany. It was the most controversial assistant rabbi appointment in the history of Judaism. So, Abraham Geiger was born in 1810 in Frankfurt am Main to a very traditional family. His father died when he was young. His brother, Solomon, was 18 years older than him and was a traditional Orthodox rabbi all throughout his career. Abraham grew up in an environment of traditional learning, and his secular studies were few and far between in his early age. But later, he would go on to expand his horizons in terms of his course of study. But his youth was spent in the traditional environment of Frankfurt Jewry. It's very important to understand his background and to see how he departs from that as he gets older. In the early stages of Reform Judaism, the changes that were made in synagogue practice were implemented not by rabbis, but rather by lay people who felt this was in the better interests of the survival of Judaism. And they hired people to function in their synagogues, in their temples, who were themselves not ordained rabbis, but had newfangled clergy positions. Guys like Edward Clay, Edward Gans, Gotthold Salomon, even Leopold Zuns. They functioned as preachers, whether in Berlin or Hamburg or elsewhere, but they were not ordained rabbis. And so in order for the Reform movement to really coalesce as a movement and not just a random temple in one or two places, there would need to be theologians, recognized scholars of the law and of Judaism, who espouse a reformist position. But how do these people come into existence if the only way to become a rabbi is the traditional route? And who's going to ordain someone if the ordaining authority is themselves an old world rabbi? Why are they going to confer a smicha or whatever title onto someone who's a known heretic? So it has to happen slowly, where someone with a traditional upbringing and goes through the process of learning, Talmudic and halachic learning, then in their teenage years or 20s is exposed to some other type of scholarship and decides to take Judaism in a new direction. It so happens that a whole bunch of these folks come into on the scene in the 1830s, where they had the traditional upbringing and learning, and possibly even ordination, but then they go to university, some German university. In Geiger's case, he did not go to yeshiva, because there really was no yeshiva in Germany in the early 19th century. Nothing to speak of. People learned privately, and he was ordained privately in 1832 at the age of 22. But what about his secular studies? So he went to the University of Heidelberg, only stayed there briefly. Then he went to the University of Bonn, where he spent 2 years, and where he interacted with Samson Raphael Hirsch, the founder of Neo-Orthodoxy. And the two were close buddies, because at the time, their worldviews were not that far apart. They would quickly diverge, and each one go their own way. But at least for a time, they were chaverim. So he goes to Bonn, and eventually he gets his degree from Marburg. His doctorate was based upon an essay that he wrote on those aspects of Judaism which were adopted by Muhammad and are found in the Quran and form the basis of Islam. For his entire career, Abraham Geiger would have a strong interest in the so-called daughter religions of Judaism. He would look to the New Testament and was the first Jew to be really a scholar of the New Testament and examine what are the Judaic origins of Christianity and see the overlap between Pharisaism or proto-rabbinism and Christianity. So that's not something you would expect of an early 19th century rabbi, to be interested in the Quran and the New Testament, but he had wider intellectual horizons. Okay, so in 1832, he becomes a rabbi in Wiesbaden, a small Jewish town on the margins of of Jewish life in Germany. And he has not done anything to tinker with practical religion at this point, but In the 1830s, he begins to publish articles, and his publications reveal that he is a free thinker. A free thinker about what? Well, I mean, there are levels of free thinking. There are those who will be critical in their approach to the study of the Talmud. There are those who are critical in the study of the Mishnah, critical in the study of the Nevi'im and Ketuvim, and the worst of all, critical in the study of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. So, early on in his career, he shows his willingness to examine with the academic microscope rabbinic literature. And later, even the prophetic literature, and even later, the Torah proper. Although that would not happen in the 1830s, that would have to wait till the 1840s and 50s. But he starts a publication, the Zeitschrift, a periodical, in which he can publish himself and other young Jewish scholars interested in getting their name out. This is a very ambitious project for a guy in his mid-20s. And it was something that was tried by Leopold Zuns and the Kulturverein, the Wissenschaftverein in the 1819-1820-1821 era, but which failed. They put out one or two publications and stopped because there wasn't enough interest in it. Who's reading this stuff? There's a limited audience for it. But Geiger was persistent, and he put out repeated publications of academic Jewish studies. Geiger's religion, when it comes down to it, is not Reform Judaism. Geiger's religion is the academic study of Judaism. And I don't know if anyone's ever coined it that way, but I'll say it here tonight. That's Geiger's true religion. He believes in elevating the critical study of Judaism to the level of university studies. And his long hope throughout his career, which never came to pass, was that there would be a faculty in Jewish theology in a recognized German university, which may be in the habit of ordaining rabbis or not. But the point is, he wanted a German university to have a department that was devoted to Mada'i Yahadut, as we would say in modern Hebrew.
But that's not the same as Judaic studies that we have today.
It is, but it depends where. In other words, the Judaic studies in Yeshiva University is not the same as the Judaic studies in Hebrew Union College. And the Judaic studies in Yeshiva College is not the same as in Lakewood. So, what he wanted was along those lines, but with an element of formal religion as well. In other words, not just a professor of whatever religious persuasion teaching Judaic studies, but Jews with some sort of ecclesiastical authority in the university, just like you have German Lutheran and Catholic universities where they issue divinity degrees. So he wanted divinity degrees being conferred upon people who studied in a university setting where there was a faculty of Jewish theology. It never came to pass. Yeah. So there have been many opponents over the years of the combining of rabbinical training and academic studies, and especially academic studies as pertain to Jewish studies, because it's all the more suspicious. But the tradition since the 1850s has been to combine the two, other than in the Haredi world. You've always had, for the last 150 years, 160 years, a seminary in which there is the critical study of the text, but which also confers degrees upon people to become rabbis in the real world. Okay, and we'll get to that in the life of Geiger, how that becomes very important. Yeah.
But you're talking about an intellectual pursuit. How did this translate into practice in
the Okay. So practice in the shul in Wiesbaden, very little changed, other than making the service more decorous, which meant German vernacular sermon, clerical robes, a choir, and the elimination of imperfections in the service, like the sale of mitzvot and talking at dead time in the service, creating a very decorous and formal synagogue worship that doesn't allow for downtime or rambunctiousness, as it might.
But that was okay. That was before Geiger.
That was before Geiger, but it should be noted that those sorts of innovations did not catch on in all places. Geiger, one of the few progressive rabbis at this point, is doing that in his hometown, but he doesn't last there very long. He leaves Wiesbaden after 1837. Because it's on the margins of Jewish life, and he wants to hit the big time. So there's a position available in Breslau, which has a large Jewish community, probably the second largest in Germany behind Berlin. And the rabbi there was Rabbi Solomon Tichtin. Solomon Tichtin was the son of Gedalia Tichtin, who was also the rabbi of Breslau. So it's a family business. And who is going to succeed Solomon? His son, Gedalia Tichtin, named after his grandfather. Family business.
Is this Orthodox?
Orthodox environment. But there are some younger members of the community who have progressive ideas, and they want someone who will give a weekly Sabbath sermon, an edifying sermon in the German language, who will instruct the young people in matters of religion, and will tend to the pastoral needs of the community. They want a second rabbi, an assistant rabbi to Tichtin. Tichtin's not really interested in the hiring of an assistant rabbi, all the more so if that fellow is going to be of a different party within Judaism as he is. And Tichtin's an old line Orthodox, allowing for no innovation whatsoever, a real fundamentalist.
Well, what do these rabbis like Tichtin do?
Yeah.
And they didn't give a drasha.
They gave drasha twice a year.
They
served in the Beis Din. They answered halacha questions, the shilas. Not much.
No social work, no...
Maybe there was an element of social work, but that was an innovation in and of itself, because beforehand the rabbi wasn't expected to do that. That's a modern notion of the clergy.
Didn't give shiurim?
Shiurim, yes, but for the learned audience, not for the amcha, not for the huge crowd that comes just to hear a drasha. That was only twice a year. Yeah. Because they were more active. Yeah, that's right. So, they're looking for someone who can combine competence in dayanut, able to execute the functions of the rabbinical office and the jurisprudential aspects of the rabbinate, but with modern knowledge. So they want basically a university-educated rabbi, who are few and far between. But it's a prestigious job. So who's going to apply? Well, there were 8 applicants. And there were 4 people who, although they didn't formally apply, let it be known that they were interested in the job. And if I could go, if I went through the names, it'd be a who's who of second generation Reform rabbis, the heavy hitters of the 1840s and 50s, whose names, some of which will emerge as we discuss tonight.
Didn't they want an Orthodox rabbi?
No, they wanted a university educated rabbi who would satisfy the particular needs that they had. Remember, the word Orthodox is not on the radar yet. Neither is the word Reform, necessarily. They want someone who is more in line with their own thinking and not the old world view of the senior rabbi.
But this must have been a rump group population of substance then.
Yes. Okay, so Geiger was invited to give a speech on a Shabbos. And he wowed the crowd in January of 1838. So the next day, by a vote of 56-1, he was hired as the assistant rabbi. 56-1 means that he gave a good sermon.
If we
don't know. But when it comes to oratory, you know, a Geiger was a skilled practitioner. He knew what he was doing.
This was a prestigious school with only 60
members. No, there were only that many people who were voting on this issue. No, it was a large congregation. But there were multiple synagogues in town, which will be very important because when they hire Geiger, Tichtin and him won't get along. They won't want to be in the same building. Okay. So they're ready to hire Geiger. He wins the vote. But the group that doesn't want him, that knows that he holds quasi-heretical, if not outright heretical, theological positions, they want to subvert the process. So a few tactics are used. One, the people in Wiesbaden who were traditionalists who thought that Geiger was no good send a message to Breslau saying, well, he didn't leave on his own. We fired him because we caught him doing Chilul Shabbos. That he was violating the Sabbath.
True or false?
Well, I don't know whether it was true or false in terms of his private behavior. That they caught him? Probably not. It was probably made up. It was fake. It may have been fake news, but it served a purpose to undermine his candidacy. The other thing is, he needed Prussian citizenship in order to take the job at Breslau. He's coming from Wiesbaden, and he's a native of Frankfurt, which was an independent city. And at that time, Germany still has dozens of principalities and states, and you need to have you don't have just one German citizenship. You have citizenship of your locale. So typically, when a clergyman was hired, the state would confer citizenship, no problem. But if the Orthodox Party wants to nix this whole deal, they can petition the state to deny that citizenship. On what grounds? So they claim that he was a political radical. And the Prussian state is not interested in having some far leftist or extreme anti-government agitator take up a position of the clergy. So they had to go through all of his writings from the previous half decade, and they came to the conclusion that it was a false charge, that he was not a political radical. Maybe he's a theologically open-minded, but politically he's mainstream. And in fact, it should be noted that although Geiger was not born a Prussian, he was born in Frankfurt and then would later go back to Frankfurt to hold the position of rabbi there, he became a Prussian patriot and favored the unification of Germany under the Hohenzollern Empire. He was not a patriotic citizen of independent Frankfurt, but rather favored the Bismarck Revolution and the unification. So those are some of the objections. Geiger has to hang out in Berlin while he's waiting for this matter to be resolved. And his finances are not very good, so he's not exactly a happy camper, but he keeps busy working on his scholarly literature. He also can't get married until he has secured the position, because you don't get married until you're financially stable. He had the same lady friend for 7 years, Emily Oppenheim, and finally in 1840, as he's about to be inaugurated, installed as the rabbi in Breslau, he was able to get married back in his hometown. Okay, so 1840, he comes on the scene, he's finally installed as the rabbi. But Tichten refuses to cooperate. He doesn't in any way recognize Geiger as a rabbi. Why not? Well, as far as he's concerned, Geiger is a shagetz. And because they won't cooperate, and yet both men are members of the Beit Din, what happens to the Beit Din? It doesn't function. So it's paralyzed. What happens if a person in town needs a get or a chalitza, which was very common in those years because people died young and you needed chalitza for levirate marriage purposes? You'd have to go two towns over to the nearest Beit Din. But in Breslau, which was a substantial Jewish community, the serious juridical functions of the rabbinate were at a standstill. That's bad. Okay. Yes, yes.
Why was the Beit Din inoperative if only one of the...
Because two out of the three wouldn't sit in the same room with each other. So what are you left with? You're left with no Beit Din. There were multiple synagogues. There was no Ochnaim. So there were multiple synagogues, and each one davened in his own shul, trying not to cross paths. There was the new group and the old group. The old group, meaning the more Orthodox, they davened in Tichten's shul, and the new group, the progressive types, davened in Geiger's shul. Geiger tried introducing some moderate reforms of the service, but he was stymied because there was a Prussian governmental decree from 1823 forbidding the introduction of reforms in the synagogue liturgy. So there wasn't that much that he could do. He also got into trouble for wearing clerical robes. And the government the Orthodox Party tried to petition the government to prevent him from doing so, and the government agreed that he shouldn't be allowed to wear the robes of Christian clergy. So what did Geiger do? He called up his buddy in the Catholic Church and in the Lutheran Church and did a careful measurement of their gowns, and he told the government, my gown doesn't exactly conform to their gowns, it's just my own private attire. And because the rabbi is not an officiant of the state, was not recognized as a state employee, but rather was just a Jewish clergyman, you can't tell me what to wear, just like you can't tell a guy to wear jeans and a t-shirt. I'm a private citizen wearing, you know, a cute outfit that's not the same as that of the Christian clergy. So leave me alone. And he won on that argument.
Why was this priority with him?
It shouldn't have been a priority, but it was a mishigas that the Orthodox were attacking him on, so he had to defend himself. And he did so successfully. It's a power struggle.
Different?
Huh?
Just to be different?
No, he liked the idea of the robe. He felt it added to the formal nature of the cathedral synagogue service. Okay.
Did the traditional rabbis of that time wear a kapota?
No, not in Germany. Not in Germany. Maybe they wore a top hat, but I don't. They didn't wear like a Eastern European kapota.
No. Like the Litvisha wear today.
Like a frock coat.
Maybe they did, but I'm trying to think of the pictures I've seen from the early era of photographs. I don't know.
But in France, they did. The rabbis were employees of the government.
The rabbis were employees of the government in France because the consistory was a government institution. Yeah.
Substantially.
Yeah.
If you look at some of his writings of that era.
Yeah. Okay, so he believed that the practical mitzvot asei, positive performative commandments, which no longer spoke to the needs of the Jews of the diaspora, who were members of the Mosaic faith and not national Jews, should be abolished. So basically, any mitzvah that smacks of nationalism was to be eliminated. Moreover, anything that was too oriental in nature was to be eliminated. But it should be noted that he didn't always act on those convictions. Throughout his career, he is not the most extreme member of the Reform clergy. That will be Samuel Holdheim and Mendel Hess, who would abolish everything if they could. Geiger was a savvy political operator who did not want to take away something from the community that they still felt was reasonably sacred, and the kind of item that if he tried to take it away would cause a rupture in communal life. And so, whatever he didn't eliminate as the rabbi of the Kehillah, he wouldn't stop observing in his personal life. So he kept kosher, despite the fact that he didn't really think it was important to keep kosher. So sukkah would be an example. If it's too oriental, it's too Middle Eastern, it should be eliminated. But you don't hear much talk about mikveh, actually, in his writings. But sukkah, or shofar, lulav, these sorts of rituals don't fit the European climate, and so he wouldn't want them. But that's not to say he didn't do them. He would continue to do them, because he's the rabbi of the town. All right. Yes. So in his synagogues, not in Breslau at first, but later in Frankfurt and in Berlin, there would be organs. Okay. Well, the fight between Tichtin and Geiger does not abate with the passage of time. Over 2 years, between 1840 and 1842, they're trying to avoid each other. But all of a sudden, there's a problem. There's a funeral of a fellow who liked both rabbis.
Are they in the same shul?
They're in the same kehillah, but different synagogue buildings.
Okay.
Yeah. But the kehillah is united. Now,
one was in the Nesach Sfarad.
Keep in mind the following. The kehillah of the town is one organization with one board and one pot of tax revenue that's being collected. But it supports multiple institutions, including more than one synagogue, just because it's a large kehillah and needs more than one physical, you know, synagogue building. That said, there was an opportunity for shalom, for peace, if each of the two rabbis would carve out for themselves a certain niche within the functions of the rabbinate. What if Tichtin took upon himself to be the Av Beis Din, the head of the rabbinical court, to give the drushes twice a year, to paskin on the chickens if they were kosher or treif. But Geiger would be the preacher of the synagogue in the German language who spoke every week and who handled the educational activities for the youth and was a pastor. Would that be good enough?
No.
So eventually, that will be good enough in some neighborhoods. In some cities in Germany, in the latter half of the 19th century, that kind of division of labor within one key law, satisfying the needs of the Orthodox and the Reform, would be possible. But not in 1841, because it's too early. And each side thinks that what I have is Judaism, and what the other has is bad, and is unacceptable, and needs to be defeated. And there should be only one key law with one style of Judaism. So Geiger won't give in. He won't become a half a rabbi, just become like a preacher and a Malamed Tinokos, a kid who teaches the children in the Cheder. And Tichtin won't give up anything. In other words, I'm the Rav of the town, and that's it. Nobody else has any say over the fate of Judaism here. So no compromise. Okay, but you have a funeral of a guy who liked both of them. And each one is supposed to give a hesped, a eulogy at the Levi at the funeral. So Tichtin goes first. And he gives his speech with a few thinly veiled jabs at Geiger and Geiger's camp. Incidentally, weeks earlier in the Shabbos Agodal Drasha, Tichtin had made not so thinly veiled jabs at Geiger also in the Drasha, saying how evil the reformers were. And at this funeral, after Tichtin speaks, it's at Geiger's turn, and there's booing and hissing from the crowd, from the frum. Geiger is smart enough to say, all right, better stop. He cuts his speech short and walks off the podium. But there was a tussle. Maybe a punch was thrown, I don't know. The police find out about it. Now, the police had been involved previously. The government has already, for 3 years, been involved in this tug of war between the traditionalists and the non-traditionalists in the community. And they're not really happy about that. The government, you know, doesn't mind being called in when something important is happening, but they don't want to have to deal repeatedly with internal Jewish feud over theological concerns. So the board decides to act decisively, and they claim that Tichtin resigned. Now, that was a farce. He didn't resign. In fact, they just wanted him out. So they came up with a pretext to say that he's on unpaid leave because of dereliction of duty. What did he fail to do? He failed to provide moral instruction in his Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, Shabbos Shuvah Drasha, that he had only offered Talmudic pilpul, but he had not given any musar. So since his obligation as a rabbi was to provide moral instruction in the Drasha, and he failed to do so, he's on unpaid leave also. He neglected the instruction of the educational institutions, and he neglected his pastoral responsibilities. Well, those were the sorts of things that Geiger was doing, and Tichtin, yeah, maybe he dropped the ball on that. So they used it as an excuse to get rid of him. The government eventually overturned that suspension and brought Tichtin back into office. But he died a few months later in March of 1843 at the age of 51. Not an old man.
He was 33, Geiger.
So Geiger, at that point, was 33, and is now the only game in town. So does Geiger win? Not so simple. Not so simple. But why? Because the Orthodox want another rabbi. They don't want Geiger. So they hire Gedalia Tichtin, Solomon Tichtin's son, to be the rabbi. But Gedalia was a young man, and didn't really have great credentials. He was sort of a third-generation Rebbe, you know. He's riding the coattails of his father and grandfather. And so the government took their time in approving his status as a Landesrabbiner. And it wasn't until 1846 that he was confirmed, and until 1854 that he was given a more elevated position legally. So what do we make of the Geiger-Tichtin controversy? A few points. One, it's that in the early phases of, well, not the earliest phase, but in the second phase of Reform Judaism, the idea of a Reform rabbi is still a novelty. And it's something that one camp within the Jewish community cannot accept. It's, to them, illogical. Why? Because...
five, 6 years, they didn't even get a real rabbi, Orthodox rabbi. So it means they had to be siding to the reform.
Okay, but those who were in the Orthodox camp, they could not accept the idea of a heterodox rabbi. And I'll quote for you from one of the missives that they sent to the government. They said the following point. Here. If he likes, let him call himself doctor or scholar or even preacher. Who can object to that? But with what right, rabbi? Meaning, the traditionalists understand that someone with great education, even halakhic knowledge, and even official smicha from some authoritative source, might hold heterodox views. But that doesn't entitle them, just because they have the official credentials, to hold the office of rabbi. What is rabbi? What is Judaism? Judaism is a religion with rules, specific rules that are codified in whatever books written hundreds of years earlier. And the rabbi's job is to fairly and accurately interpret and apply those rules to contemporary life. And if someone is not interested in doing that, then the rabbinical office is not for them. Existing Judaism is what the rabbi has to give to the masses. If someone, regardless of their halakhic credentials, wants to do something else with communal religious life, to offer them some other product, so be it. We can't stop that. But let that person call himself a preacher, or a doctor, or a pastor, but not rabbi. That rabbi has to do with official Judaism as it has been codified already, not what they wish it to be in the future. So there is no possibility for the existence of a reform rabbi. That's that viewpoint. Now, that viewpoint actually makes a lot of sense. And in the first generation of progressive Judaism in the 18-teens, that's really what happened. In other words, there were no reform rabbis. There were reform thinkers and the laity who are tinkering at the margins of synagogue life, and they're successful or unsuccessful depending upon where, you know, which temple we're talking about, but it wasn't a rabbi, because what is a rabbi? The rabbi is the representative of existing, you know, static Judaism, not an evolving Judaism. So, to counter that argument, the non-traditionalists in Breslau, who wanted Geiger to assume his role in the community, appealed to members of the German rabbinate for their opinion as to whether or not it is possible to have a so-called reform rabbi. So, which rabbis did they ask? The reform rabbis, the ones who were known to hold progressive positions. So let me read to you some of the answers that were given by the progressive rabbis on the issue of Geiger's candidacy in Breslau.
That's a rabbi.
Yeah, well, okay. So,
well, the first question is, were they rabbis?
So the answer is many of them, yes. Some not really, but most of them, yes. Okay.
So basically, the way I understand it is they went off to Dera after they got Smicha.
Correct. Okay, so one of the rabbis was Joseph Friedlander. He was the rabbi in Westphalia, and we know that Westphalia, ever since the days of Israel Jacobson, had a progressive streak to it. And he said that if a rabbi is enacting change, practical change in the conduct of synagogue services and in the conduct of Jewish communal life more generally, it can be acceptable, because after all, Hora'at Sha'ah. What is Hora'at Sha'ah? The need of the moment. Exigencies of the moment. It's emergency enactment. Now, what's the problem with claiming Hora'at Sha'ah? Because it comes and it goes. It doesn't last forever. Unless, like, it's the state of emergency in Egypt, which was enacted by Nasser in 1952 and never lapsed. It somehow stayed around for 60 years. So Hora'at Sha'ah is a nice argument. Yeah.
There were those who claimed that Hirsch and his way of doing it was really Hora'at Sha'ah.
Right, that Torah im Derech Eretz was not a legitimate philosophy long term. It was only Hora'at Sha'ah, yeah.
That's what the opposition tried to label it.
Yes. Okay. Now, What about Aaron Koren? So Aaron Koren was an old man at this point. He was in his mid-70s. And he had been a veteran of the wars of the Hamburg Temple, who had supported the organ and the vernacular prayers and the like. What does he have to say in favor of Geiger? He quotes certain halachic sources, including the Rambam and the Rama, that l'chazek hadat, if something is done to strengthen religion, even if it might look as though it's an undermining of religion, it can be perfectly okay. Alternatively, certain things are done by tikkun olam. Now, tikkun olam here doesn't mean the tikkun olam of like the 1970s America or the current climate, where it means a certain political agenda. Tikkun olam there meant that there's a problem with sustaining Judaism. And the olam means the olam of Jewry, not the broader olam. So you do things to affect the survival of Judaism, even though it might look like the diminution of Judaism. Okay? Then he said like this, "It is absolutely against the spirit of our holy religion to either condemn or excommunicate a rabbi because of individual views or opinions concerning temporary forms of our faith." Now, what are the temporary forms of our faith?
The Orthodox.
No. Temporary forms means ceremonial mitzvot that in the viewpoint of a progressive has lost its hold over the people. Its time has come and gone. Now, from a strictly Orthodox point of view, there is no religious ceremonial whose time has come and gone. If it's a mitzvah in the Torah, it's supposed to be around forever. There's the nitzchiut, there's the eternality of the Torah commandments. But if you take the point of view that the core is only sort of the moral law, and the side aspects of Judaism are the ceremonials, then they are temporary in nature. And if someone wants to do away with them, then they have not done damage to true religion. So that's Aaron Koren really being very to the left, very far to the left. Even worse, much worse than he was in 1819 when he tolerated the Hamburg Temple reforms. Okay, Samuel Holdheim was the real radical, even more so than Geiger. And he described it as this, that there is a distinction between temporary and eternal in religion, between the perishable shell and the everlasting kernel of divine truth. So the everlasting kernel is ethical monotheism, basically. And what is the perishable shell? Saturday Sabbath, kashrus, everything else. Well, if you take that approach, very little is left. And in fact, in Samuel Holdheim's Reform congregation in Berlin, there was almost nothing left. It was hardly Jewish at all. He dabbled in the Sunday Sabbath.
So it seems that you're denying the divine writing of the Old Testament.
Okay, so I'm glad you brought that up. What's not being denied here is the divine revelation of the Old Testament, or the one-time binding character of Mosaic law. Today, the biblical minimalists and those who believe in the documentary hypotheses and who teach in the heterodox seminaries will say that there was very little or nothing of a divine character to the text proper. These reformers are not saying that five guys wrote the Bible 2,500 years ago as opposed to God 3,200 years ago. They're not saying that. What they're saying is even if it was a divine revelation, it was of passing significance, temporary significance, that the ceremonials, which no longer fit the current climate, even God himself who promulgated them would no longer want us to observe them. So that's very different from saying there never was a divine command.
So it's a question of split hooves and chewing cud.
Yeah.
An animal that doesn't do so,
right.
The commandment was just temporary.
Correct. Correct. Okay. Yeah.
By what authority did they make these changes? They had an idea.
None, other than their own say-so. They believe that their assessment of the worth of various aspects of Judaism is correct. They're assuming the correctness of their view in determining what's valuable and what's not.
So what do they do for fun? I mean, kids, yeah. Kids, some Pistora, if you're Orthodox, or you have the shofar they look forward to, or a Purim, they seem to have eliminated all that from their...
Sure,
Rabbi,
now,
that's why they like a group of that.
Even more than fun, there's no demands, there's no borders, there's no separation. What is there? Where's the there to the religion? That doesn't seem to be any there.
There isn't much. You're right. There isn't much.
Are they getting rid of some rabbinic decrees?
Huh?
And just sticking with Chumash?
Okay, so the distinction between the Chumash and the rabbinic decrees is not something that really is relevant in German reform. It will become relevant in British reform, where they basically were like Karaites. And maybe in 1 or 2 weeks from now, when we discuss reform in England, we'll look at those figures who wanted biblical, specifically Pentateuchal authority for whatever religious observances they have, and will reject anything that postdates that. In Germany, we don't really have that kind of absolute distinction. Okay, yeah.
They have 2 days Yom Tov.
Oh, that's going to be a big fight. So in the Reform Rabbinical Conferences, which we'll talk about in 2 weeks, that is a major topic, and they want to get rid of the second day Yom Tov. But it's not such a simple thing, because it has been entrenched in Jewish life for a long time, and if the rabbi is in control of a congregation of mixed opinion, to take such a radical move as getting rid of the second day Yom Tov runs the risk of really dividing the Kehillah sharply. So second day Yom Tov, in theory, has been abolished by the reform movement as early as the 1840s, but the question reemerges in the late 1860s and never fully goes away, because people have a sentimental attachment to 2 days Yom Tov. Yeah.
I know.
Wasn't the shofar something that people may not have understood why, but did they still hear it?
Ancient custom, it depends upon your perspective. Ancient custom can appeal to your sense of devotion to ancestral ways, in which case you have a favorable view of it. Or ancient custom, forget the custom, it's just ancient. And ancient equals bad. Middle East, well, that's the other factor. It's not of our part of the world.
On Pesach, you can walk down the streets of New York and look at a tray for a restaurant and see a box of matzah.
Because in America, Judaism has certain sentimental attachments to the customary past.
Cultural.
But we're cultural, yeah. But in mid-19th century Germany, among those who care about these things, the theologians who have an agenda, there is very little sentimental attachment to the ways of the past. Okay, let me just read to you another viewpoint of Holdheim. He contended that the duty of the Jew in this matter was to believe in the principle of tradition as exemplified in the Talmud, but not in the Talmud as such, nor in the utterance of the rabbis of ancient times as such. Basically, the difference is between tradition and the traditions. The Reform, they like tradition, but not the traditions. Now, is that a legitimate distinction, or is that Baba Maisa?
I don't understand what that means.
It's a very flimsy nuance. The notion of, I like tradition, but not the traditions. So I'll pick away at the ones that I don't like. Yeah.
They like a certain amount of hierarchy.
Yeah.
They like the expectation of you do this, you do this. I just find it interesting that this, the whole.
So the answer is in personal life, the Jews who had walked away from strict, rigorous observance, were not interested in high impact Judaism. They wanted low impact Judaism. Where they wanted to follow orders was in a synagogue service that was predictable, that did not have the chaos of the shtiebel. So in that regard, it was very yekish. But in terms of personal observance, they want as limited impact in their private lives as possible.
But how much of it also was driven by the fact that they wanted to blend in?
So some of that, yes, but a lot of it even not. A lot of it is just the laziness factor, or you don't like impinging upon your freedoms. Okay.
Now, it took 200 or 300 years before Jews finally broke off and they called themselves Christians.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that that did not happen in the case with Reform Judaism.
Okay, so next week when we discuss the Frankfurt Society of Reform, that almost does. They are the most extreme group in the mid-1840s, and most of them cease to be identifiable Jews. So next week, that will be an important point.
Next week we meet.
Are we going to meet Chol HaMoed or no?
Why not?
Leil Hashanah Rabba?
Oh, it's Leil Hashanah Rabba? Oh, forget
all
it.
All the more reason.
I don't know. So then nothing next week.
It's just a tradition.
Okay. No, actually. No. It's a good point. No class next week. So that's another topic we're going to spend a lot of time on because of attempts to abolish it. Okay. Now, Abraham Cohen was another one of the reformist rabbis who defended Geiger. And he was a sad case. He was appointed rabbi in Lemberg, in Lvov, in Galicia, in 1844. So he was a German rabbi who went to Galicia, which was a rarity, because Galicia was a stronghold of traditional Judaism. But it was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and so they could import someone from further west. And he was known for being an opponent of the Orthodox, so somebody poisoned his food and he died. In 1848, he was killed. Abraham Cohen was poisoned to death by a fanatic in the opposing party.
And we all laughed.
Yes, absolutely. Holtheim did, yeah, sure. He became a radical. Okay, now another concern, another figure who chimed in was David Einhorn. Now, David Einhorn, we'll learn a lot more about him when we discuss American Judaism. Because Einhorn would go to Baltimore and then Philadelphia and play an important role in the American Civil War. But he's a rabbi in Germany in the 1830s and 1840s. And he says the following, like this. The departure from ceremonial laws, which is the result neither of caprice nor frivolity, but the outcome of honest conviction that such departure is in keeping with the spirit of Judaism and is a pressing demand of its natural development does not unfit a man from holding rabbinical office. In other words, as long as the changes that you're making are not based upon your indifference to Judaism or a cavalier approach to Judaism, but rather is based upon sincere concern for the long-term viability of the religion, that even if you dismantle parts of the religion, you have not done wrong and you can retain the rabbinical office. Einhorn's point is basically something that all the reformers would agree with, except that not all of them would express it in such stark terms. What he's saying is, if you're not a shyster, if you really mean it, if you're sincere, then anything goes. But who's to determine that you're sincere and not just an enemy of Judaism looking to undermine it left and right? Who's to determine that? We're supposed to trust you? Have there been charlatans in the rabbinate? Absolutely. Have there been enemies of Judaism in the rabbinate? Absolutely. So he's saying, as long as you wholeheartedly mean it, it's okay. Yeah.
Are they talking about Torahic law versus rabbinical law, or some of them are even
Torah law? Yes, even Torah law. Yeah? Okay.
One question.
Yeah.
With all this going on, it's obviously, in my sense, involved in the overwhelming majority of Jewish people.
No.
Probably many of them were just off base completely. This was just a little bit of a squabble between people and.
So, there were places where the common man didn't care, and this was just a squabble between rabbis. But it did matter in some towns where there wasn't going to be a compromise. One side was going to win, and if your side lost, you suffered real-world consequences. In other words, if the Reform side won and you were an Orthodox fellow in a smaller town in Germany, what happened to the supervision of the mikveh? What happened to the availability of legitimately kosher food? What happens to the ability to have a synagogue with Orthodox ritual? Are you going to have to pay for this privately? These are poor people. the taxes are only supporting one institution. If that one doesn't satisfy your religious needs, you are in a real turmoil. So that's what was one of Hirsch's complaints. What about the opposite direction? What if the Orthodox win and you're a reformist? So Hirsch would say, well, then so be it. Even the reformists could live with Orthodox Judaism. But that's a very triumphalist point of view. It says, well, you know, my way is good for everybody, but your way is bad for me. No, the reformist in an Orthodox environment would be dissatisfied, legitimately concerned for his spiritual fate. So it does matter where you can't have both options. But where you can have both options, within the Kehila, everybody could walk away happy, maybe with a nasty look towards the other side of the aisle, but everyone could have their needs taken care of.
That's what happened with...
with Gemeinde Orthodoxy, yes.
Yeah, within Frankfurt.
Under Rabbi Horowitz.
Or the Orthodox.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Was the distancing from tradition the only motivating force, or was there also a pull towards Germanic nationalism?
Okay, so let's now talk about the rest of Geiger's career. In the 15 minutes we have left, and that will address your question. So, whether there was an aspect of German nationalism involved in Reform Judaism, some unrelated to just a departure from traditional observance. So the answer is yes. There was a strong element of German patriotism that expressed itself in the various wars, the Prussia-Austrian War of 1866, the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, where, you know, a German Jew would say, you know, my team is the good guys, and the other side are bad or evil, even though there were Jews fighting in the other army. But they firmly believed in the correctness of their cause. Some of them became fanatical patriots. Okay, so Geiger, he functioned in Breslau from 1840 until 1862. A fairly long time. He never got what he really wanted. What he wanted was an academic appointment. And there were two possibilities. One was at a German university, but that didn't happen. That was a pipe dream. That was never going to happen. The other would be at a Jewish seminary of high academic standing that didn't exist in the 1840s, but there was talk of it, and there was a desire to create one. And in 1850, the first stirrings towards the creation of a Jewish seminary happened, because there was an estate left behind with a lot of money by a certain fellow, Mr. Frankel, who wanted to have a rabbinical seminary. And it was going to be built in Breslau, in Geiger's town. So what makes the most sense? That the local rabbi becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, I mean, to use an old world term. They wouldn't use that term, but you know what I mean. But they didn't choose Geiger. To his great chagrin, his foe, Zacharias Frankel, the founder of positive historical Judaism, the forerunner of conservative Judaism, basically, he was selected to be the leader of the Jewish Theological Seminary of Breslau, which opened its doors in 1854 and was, for the next 80 years, a very important institution in Jewish life. It ordained hundreds of middle-of-the-road rabbis. I won't use the term conservative, I would use the term middle of the road, moderate reform, neither Orthodox nor reform, in between. We're going to spend a lot of time on Frankel when we get to him. So he was chosen to lead this seminary, and Geiger was overlooked, and he was furious. Plus, his wife died in 1860, at a fairly young age. He was only 50 at the time, she was in her late 40s. So he was kind of miserable because the kids were moving out of the house, the wife was dead, he didn't get the academic appointment. The Breslau community, as much as he liked it, was on the margins of geographic margins of Germany. He wanted to get into where the cultural life really was happening. So the job in Frankfurt opens up. Who had been the rabbi in Frankfurt? So Leopold Stein was the rabbi in Frankfurt. What happened to Samson Raphael Hirsch? He was never the rabbi in Frankfurt. He was the rabbi of the IRG, the breakaway Orthodox. But he was not the town rabbi.
When Leopold Stein
was moderate reform. But that's the nature of the community. That's why there was a need for breakaway Orthodox, because the main Kehillah was no longer Orthodox. But Leopold Stein got into a fight with the board of directors, and after about a year of it festering, he was out of a job. So Geiger was willing to put his hat in the ring, and he got the job. It was his hometown. He was now 52 years old, a widower, but a prestigious rabbi, and they gave him the job. Was he happy there? Well, it turned out all of his old friends were gone, and he wasn't so happy there. Although it was geographically towards the center of the country, it was no longer an out-of-the-way place like Breslau, still it wasn't the center of cultural life he thought it would be. That would remain Berlin, the elusive prize. So Geiger is there from 62 through 69. Then in 1869, the call comes from Berlin. Do you want to be the rabbi? And he says, yes. And they're willing to pay him a nice chunk of change, too. What was the story in Berlin? Michael Sachs was the rabbi in Berlin. Michael Sachs was another middle-of-the-road character like Zacharia Frankel. Neither Reform nor fully Orthodox. And the community in Berlin was accustomed to this moderate leadership. There was a radical Reform congregation led by Holdheim, but that was on the fringe. There was also a strictly Orthodox congregation, which was eventually led by Hildesheimer. But the main congregation was in need of a rabbi. They brought in Geiger. Were the Orthodox happy that the grandfather of Reform was now the rabbi of the town? No. Could they do anything about it? No. Was Geiger happy? Yes. But there's one more thing he wants, desperately. He wants an academic institution that he could call his own. But he got lucky. In the last years of his life, the money was put into place for the establishment of the Hochschule für die Wissenschaft des Judentum, the High Academy for the Science of Judaism. What he was hoping for was not really a rabbinical seminary, but an institution of academic Jewish studies, where he could teach a little bit, and it would be a home for him and other scholars to do their work. In fact, it turned out to become a Reform rabbinical school. But even though it was a Reform rabbinical school, it always had this veneer of non-denominationalism until it was shut down in Kristallnacht. So he's appointed the professor of Jewish history, and for 2 years, 1872 until his death in 1874, he is functioning as the Rav HaKehillah of Berlin and the leading professor at the Hochschule. They were great years of his life, the last 2 years. He dies of a cerebral hemorrhage in 1874 after having not been ill. He was with great vigor, even in the last days of his life. Last day, he taught for a few hours, did his work, and went to sleep, and the next morning, he woke up dead. Okay? So, it's a neat trick. Whatever it was, he was a young 64. And it was the end of an era, because after him, there needed to be new leadership in the Reform camp. Yeah?
You said that the money came from the government to support a Kehillah. So whether it became Reform, that
was... No, I didn't say the money came from the government. The money came from taxes.
Jewish taxes. Oh, because Berlin had enough money to support those three segments?
So Berlin had a lot of money, Berlin Jewry. And the Kehillah taxes did not support all those institutions. The Reform were privately funded. There was a separatist Orthodox that was privately funded. There was a Gemeinde Orthodox, which was communally funded. There was the mainstream synagogue, which was under Geiger's auspices, which was communally funded. And the rabbinical seminaries, whether Orthodox or Hochschule, were privately funded, but not from communal taxes, but from philanthropy. What Geiger wanted, and he didn't get, was government funding of the Hochschule. He felt, and this is an important point which we'll have to close, he wanted Judaism to be on par with Christianity, vis-a-vis the state. That there no longer are Christian authorities, because the state is no longer Christian. The state is a secular institution, not affiliated with any denomination. And so you could have a Jew be the Minister of Finance or the Minister of the Interior, whatever it is. There's no religious test for office holding, and the state is not a Christian state. Therefore, if the state is funding divinity schools at the highest academic level of the various Christian denominations, it should also provide funding for a Jewish such institution. But it didn't. It had to be out of wealthy Jewish donors. And thank God there were enough of those to go around to support high-level academic places for Jewish studies. But it did show that despite emancipation and despite theoretical equality, there wasn't absolute equality in Germany, even after the Bismarck Revolution. Okay, any other questions?
What was the reaction of the lay people and the various streams of rabbis to Geiger's death?
I don't know, other than that he had a big funeral. I would say this. I did not find in the literature that there were orthodox pronouncements of Baruch HaTov HaMetiv, blessing the Almighty for the downfall of our evil, wicked foe. That I don't find. Which, by the way, did happen when other dubious characters died. But not, as far as I could tell, not with Geiger.
But it sounds, after a whole evening of listening to you, that Geiger wanted Judaism to be like Christianity in terms of religion as well, not just
okay.
in terms of institutions of learning,
but yeah.
or academics.
Okay, so
what was the difference all right. between Judaism and Christianity?
Geiger was a theoretical radical, in the sense that in his writings, the kind of Judaism that would have emerged if you didn't have to compromise due to communal pressures would have been devoid of ceremonial that made it distinctively Jewish. You're right. It would have looked a whole lot like some other religion. But in practice, Geiger capitulated to the needs of the community, which was a diverse community, and did not put the Shabbos on Sunday, did not abolish kashrus observance, did not abolish the various holidays. He continued to observe them in his public life because he was the rabbi of a Jewish community that still felt the need for those things. So there's a wide gap between what his inner convictions would have called for and what was the reality on the ground in his kihilot. Now you could ask, what about when he went on vacation? So actually in his biography, by Max Wiener, Abraham Geiger and Liberal Judaism, that's the most interesting page of them all. What did he do when he went on vacation? So as a communal rabbi, he has to toe the line of pseudo-halachic practice in the presence of the general public. But when he went away, what did he do? So it tells a story how he went to Paris, and his sister lived there, and the nieces and nephews, and it was Tisha B'Av. And he convinced them to break their fast at lunchtime. But he didn't eat meat. He only ate dairy on Tisha B'Av.
It was the nine days.
So he wouldn't eat meat on Tisha B'Av. But not only did he break his fast, he told his religious siblings and nieces and nephews to break their fast. Now, what kind of crazy situation is that?
That they listened or that he told them?
That he told them this odd permutation of don't fast on Tisha B'Av, but I'm not going to eat meat.
Did he eat out?
Ah, so that's the other question. Did he eat out? And he complained when he was in Strasbourg that the kosher restaurant was needlessly expensive. Now, what does that tell you? That he really would have preferred to eat treif and save the money. But for whatever reason, something held him back from eating non-kosher. And even when he was in the privacy of his own vacation, he didn't eat treif. But he didn't see religious value in keeping kosher, and therefore would complain about the temporal cost of maintaining halachic standards of dietary laws.
When I asked you earlier in the evening, yeah. right, throughout mikvah, you said you didn't know, you weren't sure. I understand that you're supposed to build a mikvah even before you build a shul. I mean,
okay, so
the first priority.
So mikvah observance among those who were in the progressive camp was not widely practiced. Where mikvah comes into play is with conversion. And conversion was addressed at the various rabbinical conferences and the lay conferences in Leipzig and Augsburg in the late 1860s, early 1870s, whether or not conversion required circumcision and whether it required immersion in a ritual bath. The very fact that they're asking about these things means that mikveh is still on their mind for some limited purposes, but probably just for conversion. Now, in an earlier time, actually in the rabbinical conferences of 1845 in Frankfurt, they asked whether or not mayim she'uvim can be used to fill a mikveh. What is mayim she'uvim?
Standing water.
So water that is drawn water, as opposed to water that was rainwater that came down directly or from a natural source. So that they were asking about mayim she'uvim means two things. One, there were places where it was difficult to build a legitimately kosher mikveh, and two, that there were enough people interested in using it that they had to ask the question about like a substandard mikveh. But that also tells us that the rabbinical conferences of the 1840s involved rabbis who were catering not just to radical reform constituencies. These were town rabbis that included laity that were still traditional and wanted to observe to the best of their ability. But there were practical obstacles to things like mikveh. So therefore, what about mayim she'uvim? Now, it could be the person asking the question couldn't care less, personally. But he needed to know, as a policy matter, what should we do in our town? Can we relax the law on this very weighty issue? So it's a weighty issue, even if privately they were dismissive of it. Okay, so we'll stop here.